Sorry.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll continue with today, talk a little bit about looking back, what stuck out to each of us and what we think good research questions would be. And then if we need to touch base next month again before the big call, we can decide that at the end. Does that sound like a good course of action for to everyone?
Sure.
All right. I'm looking at the Google page, and Jackie, your notes are first. So do you want to start the discussion?
Sure. I guess probably for me, not having a lot of background in physical education, I'm not really possible. My possible research question still might be too broad. I'm not sure. But kind of reading through things, the main things I saw that stuck out, we talked a lot about the sample representativeness, kind of just if students even first of all understand that a sample can be representative of the population, let alone the bias associated with the sampling. We talked a lot last time, especially about where our students begin in the first place, a lot about more kind of what they think a sample is. But just kind of wondering where our students begin, since a lot of stuff I think that we've read has been more high school or under. Let's see. One thing we saw in a few different papers was that idea of the stochastic versus the experimental, that, you know, when students understood the idea of probability and resampling when they were, you know, drawing from like a jar of marbles, but the idea of trying to kind of do that idea with actual experiments and understanding if that truly was a good enough sample, if it was representative enough, I think had another issue. The last paper we talked about, too, with the context, you know, like the Chicago question, you know, does the context really influence the student's response, like the Pepsi versus Coke kind of idea? If you remove context, does that actually have an impact versus having the context there? And, of course, my little bread and butter is my own conditional probability, where a lot of my thought process, I think, was when I was going back, but I was emphasizing that probably the most. So I try to take what I kind of saw as our five main ideas and try to get research questions for each of them. Read with a few of your guys's, I think some of them are similar, more with the sampling probably, though. So I know one thing we talked about was the idea of inference, and we do this, you know, unit on probability. Do students have to have an understanding of conditional probability to actually truly understand inference? So the second research question there of confusing, you know, the inverse of itself kind of tied to that as well. So I think that one's probably maybe a little bit more narrow of a question, hopefully. understanding if students can actually think of sample being representative. And then where college students start, I think, is where we had a lot of talk last time, is if we could figure out where a student start, it might help us understand where they are and how to explain things a little bit better. And, of course, my last one, I said that I'm shooting really high here. How can we get rid of the personal preference and bias of students' understanding? Because we talked a few times when, you know, if they can actually believe the hypothesis test results, they take it easier. But if it ends up showing to be, you know, counterintuitive to what they thought, they have a harder time really believing it. And so is there a way of getting rid of this, you know, personal bias, in a sense, with understanding inference? So those are kind of my main things. Is there questions or comments on any of it?
Well, I was thinking we could just even back that last one up and just sort of investigate how much does that affect. I mean, that's, you know, you're kind of, how much does that affect students understanding the sampling, or how much they let their personal bias affect how they interpret hypothesis test results, or how much they believe? Like, not necessarily worrying about getting rid of it, but just really investigate how much of that affects them, because I think, you know, we all kind of have that intuitive notion that they're doing that, and we've seen that, but, you know, I think we could even back it up and just sort of investigate, you know, how much does that really come into their interpretations? I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, when you say how much, are you talking about in what types of situations, or kind of degrees of belief or disbelief, or maybe a little of both?
Maybe a little of both, I guess. I hadn't totally fleshed that out, I guess. I guess just, that's a good question.
Because there seems to be, what we saw in the literature was that there was this difference between kind of this purely stochastic drawing marbles from a barrel or something along those lines, and then the more contextual things where people would actually have some familiarity and be able to relate in some ways. So you might be able to, say, vary the degrees of the context or look at...
Well, maybe that's what I meant. Maybe, like, looking at, you know, if there's more context to the problem, do students have more bias? Or if we, I don't know, maybe when you're talking about degrees of bias, you know, can we sort of identify what it is? Can we identify factors in a problem that, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm making any sense.
Well, I think, I mean, it sounds interesting to me if you have, like, a contextualized problem or a contextualized set of problems and then some either, like, decontextualized or just, you know, drawing marbles out of a barrel kind of a thing. And, you know, maybe it would be kind of neat to compare students' performance on those two things, like in terms of, you know, you're kind of talking, I guess, about levels of understanding. One of the models that Jane Watson and some other statistics education researchers have used for a framework for levels of thinking is called the SOLO taxonomy. I don't know if I can't remember if that's been in any of the papers that we've read, but that's a way of just kind of a general framework for categorizing responses. And so it could be that, you know, maybe students have a really high level of response on decontextualized ones versus contextualized or vice versa. But that would be, I mean, it sounds like, you know, it could be really interesting just to compare even just qualitatively how they respond to those different types of questions. So I think that would be a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I've seen this, so I might not be in one of the papers, but maybe I might have looked at it when I was doing my thesis. So I remember SOLO. I just don't remember
all the different
pieces.
Yeah, it's used a lot by the Australian researchers in, like, New Zealand. They've used it quite a bit with their statistics education research. I haven't seen quite as much of it lately. I guess the one place that was mentioned in our readings just really briefly was in Mike Shaughnessy's chapter from the 2007 research handbook. He's got just a few paragraphs about it in there. But, I mean, yeah, I think it sounds like we're just kind of brainstorming it right now, but if that is a direction that, you know, that you decide to go, that's one of the resources that's out there.
Oh, yeah. I just Googled it, and it's looking vaguely familiar now. The pre-structural thinking, unistructural, multistructural, and relational.
Yeah.
I think that was in one of our readings.
Yeah.
Or at least she adapted it. She might not have called it the SOLO taxonomy, but I'm pretty sure she used that was in one of our readings, even from last month, maybe.
Oh, yeah. There are a couple of papers by Jane Watson where she kind of lays out the levels of understanding, but doesn't explicitly use the SOLO citation. But then she does, like, in different papers. It's almost like it kind of depends upon which journal they sent it to, whether or not they want to emphasize it. But
does seem to be a framework that she uses a lot to differentiate students' levels of thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Are there any other questions or comments about Jackie's research questions? All right. Jackie, I know you were wondering, or you made a couple comments when you started about not being sure if these are specific enough, and I know that's something that Joan has really tried to encourage, is that one of the problems with educational research is the research questions are so broad that even if you answer them, you still don't really know much. But one of the things I was thinking that's where we benefit from as a group is one of us can kind of postulate this somewhat broad idea, and then we can work together to start to break it down and figure out, like, okay, how can we really approach this? So I think
that last one took me a while. I know I wasn't near as specific as I wanted to be, but it kind of came from, I did a little experiment in my class, and I made two different batches of brownies.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't tell them, obviously, you know, which was which. And they actually ended up telling me that the generic ones tasted better than the Betty Crocker. And so they didn't believe me because, you know, that's counterintuitive to what they thought would be true, right? You know, so it's sort of like, it's just data. I mean, you know, just because it turns out the opposite of what you expected, you know, doesn't mean it's wrong. So I think that was a little frustrating for me.
Yeah.
It was less than some good generic brownies, but, you know.
Yeah, I know. We should find out what a
this sounds like an experiment we really should carry out.
Brilliant.
I think we need more data on this.
Yeah. But, no, I completely agree. And I think that's something really interesting, too, because it can be frustrating. There's places where having context is important, but then it can be frustrating if the context is clouding them from kind of the statistical ideas or appreciating the data. So I certainly think that's something that's interesting and is worth exploring more.
Yeah.
Well, then, Tara, do you want to talk a little bit about your comments and question ideas?
Sure. My last one actually was contextual also, so I'll start with number 3 on my list. We had spent a lot of time talking about contextual problems, how they get in the way of students' understanding. And the last paper that we read actually recommended that you investigate how the wording of the contextual problems influences answers. So that was one of the questions that I had listed. I also had, from our discussion about simulations, I think those were also on our last conference call, and how it's so important to use them, but really what are the students getting out of them and what's the appropriate way to use them. That was something that you had suggested, Harla.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my second one for part 3 on my list. What is the appropriate way to introduce them in an introductory course? What are some misconceptions the students develop, and what understanding are they getting? What are they getting out of using them? My other one, the other thing that I'm very interested in investigating how students progress in their thinking about statistical concepts, similar to the Watson stuff. But I also pulled out of the Castro-Sotis conference, or paper that we read for our second conference call, where they commented about the number of misconceptions that students walk out of intro classes with. We had commented in that conference call that all of them were post-tests, that they didn't really look at where the students were at when they came in and where they were when they left. So that was something that I was interested in. What were the common misconceptions they had when they entered the statistics classroom? And then how did they change over the course of the semester? And I think that kind of ties in with what we had talked about last time with where are they when they come in, what's their level. But it takes it a little bit further with investigating what do they learn, where do they go over the course of the semester. So kind of where are they when they come in, where are they when they leave. My last one, I was trying to pick out something that maybe we wouldn't have in other questions. And I picked out from the Discussing Statistics textbooks and developing the atmosphere that encourages the students. Because some of the research that we read showed, I think it makes sense, that the more engaged they are, the more they're going to learn and the more they're going to get out of their class. And I had been at a presentation when I was reading back through our notes, I remembered a presentation that I had been at, I think it was a year and a half or 2 years ago, and it talked about changing the physics classroom atmosphere from one that was more lecture-based to having the students engaged, having expectations for when they come in terms of developing guided reading questions, helping them read through the textbook, and then as a result, you're able to do more hands-on activities in the classroom. You don't have to spend as much time giving notes. So I thought it might be interesting to see if something similar could be in statistics, and that was just something I kind of threw in. I know it's not something we've discussed in detail, but that's where I was at, so.
Anyone have questions or comments?
Would you believe that if we were going to do something with the guided reading, we'd all have to be using the same textbook? Or would we be able to be using two different textbooks? I mean, a lot of times, you know, I think our universities require certain textbooks, and we can't automatically just change them.
I agree, and I actually don't think that, I personally don't think that we all would need to be using the same textbooks, but, again, my research experience is in engineering, so I've not done a lot of educational research, so I don't.
Me either. Well, cause I hate my required textbook I have to use. I don't even make the students buy it because I hate it. It was written by a few people that used to work here, and we only use it here. Kind of thing. So it's one of those, like, a forced textbook. I can't use something else, but I don't like it.
Yeah, I would think actually that having different textbooks might even be an advantage based on what kind of research question you're working from, because if you do have different textbooks, you could report on how students read the different types of textbooks. So that could be a strength if that was the research question.
Yeah. Jackie, though, would you feel comfortable making students read that one then? Like, how would that work?
I would probably try to talk my department ahead into allowing me to use a different book for research purposes. Maybe my goal. Maybe I can finally actually use the textbook I do like. But I feel like, you know, if the point is to do guided reading, and if I'm not teaching the way the book does, I think that'd be hard. You know what I mean? So I almost need to find a textbook that does things the way that I do them.
Yeah.
Or that at least that I can match better.
We're actually going to try something kind of similar to this idea in the course that I teach next. I think it'll be next fall. I don't think we'll have it together by the spring term. But rather than guided reading directly out of the textbook, what we're going to do is we're going to give them out of 3 hours for the course, we're going to give them 2 hours where they're required to learn lecture material from online presentations. So it's going to be kind of like what the webinars does when they have the webinars captured, where it's the PowerPoint with the audio. So we're going to have them look at that on their own time and learn the lecture material on their own time. And then for their third hour, they're going to come in for an entirely activities-based class period where it's going to be all group work and all student-led and student-focused, and the teacher's really just kind of there to answer questions, which I think is just, you know, the modern technology take on the guided reading. So that's something.
So kind of a blend of sort of a distance learning type of and...
Yeah, like a hybrid class?
Like a hybrid class?
Yeah, kind of like a hybrid class. I think for some reason we're leery of calling it that. But, yeah, that's basically what it's going to be. So that would be something we can kind of – our goal is to try it out for a few semesters and work out the kinks in the lectures and work out the kinks – the recorded lectures and work out the kinks in the activities. And then once we get kind of a good usable model, maybe try some formal testing. So that might be an idea that we could return to in various forms a little further down the line too.
I've done guided reading. I don't do it in my statistics class, but I've done it with, I teach a math class for our nursing majors, and I teach them how to do dosage calculations. And I have found that I do guided reading questions with them, and they have a form they have to complete before they come into the classroom. And it gets me through notes much faster, and then as a result, we spend most of the class doing actual calculations and hands-on activities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was a much more manageable amount of material. Like, the statistics curriculum is, there's so much to do. And we cover 600 pages of the textbook in a semester, whereas this is like a little 200-page textbook. So it was fairly straightforward for me to do guided reading with them. But it made a huge difference in the class for that one anyway.
So I'm sorry, maybe I kind of missed this. Exactly what is guided reading again?
Before they come in to the classroom, they have to, I give them a list of questions. So it's basically, it's touching on what they should be focusing on when they read through the textbook. So any definitions, they should already have them listed on their paper when they come in. They should have been able to pull them out. And then I will add material based on what they pulled out of their textbook. But it makes them more involved in class also, because they're giving me the answers to fill into the notes, and then I'll elaborate or I'll go out and do an example for them or stuff like that.
Okay.
But it brings that requirement. They've all already read the material, so they've seen it once when they're coming in. And they've pulled all the most important pieces out of their textbook, and then I'm supplementing it, and we're doing practice in class. So they're starting that processing piece in class.
Yeah.
They've already had the first sight piece, and now they're beginning to actually process before they leave the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's the goal of it anyway.
Do you feel like you get better questions from them from that? I didn't phrase that well. Because I don't know, I have days where I'm like, you know, any questions? And they just sort of look at me and, you know, I know they're not totally following everything, but nobody asks any questions. So, like, do you feel like do they ask questions, I guess, is what I'm asking?
Yes, they ask questions, yeah.
Okay.
They ask very specific questions.
Okay.
I don't think I can use my dosage calculation class as a basis, though, of what I would see in the statistics classroom, because the dosage calculation class, I teach them a technique. I teach them what they call dimensional analysis, and we do all the problems like that, so it's really reinforced throughout the whole semester. So by the time I get to the end, they know all the terminology. They're right on, you know, they ask really good questions.
Okay.
And statistics are content so varied.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what would happen. And we've talked about the readability of the textbooks. Are the textbooks even written in such a way that they could read them and complete questions that would help them? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, no, that would be my question is would they even, I mean, they could pull the definitions out, but would they get anything out of that for some of the stuff? You know, they can copy down a definition, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they've processed any of that.
Correct. And I think that's where the actual lesson piece comes in, because you take the definition and then you build on it. You can do examples with them. It just really, for me, it gets me through notes faster so I can do more hands-on and actual calculation stuff in the classroom. I don't have to spend all that time writing the definition up because I already have it. I don't know.
Are there any other questions or comments about Tara's piece? All right. My piece is next then. And I really focus on the sampling thing for kind of two reasons. I saw it coming up a little bit throughout each of the calls, and then especially on our last call. And I think what kind of stands out to me is that there's just so much even wrapped up when you talk about this idea of student understanding of sampling. There's really so much wrapped up in that. And it's the foundation of what we do, not only because it's the foundation of good inference in terms of making research results generalizable, but it's also the foundation when you get to this idea of repeated sampling. It's the theoretical foundation for everything that we do. So my questions here all really revolved around that idea of sampling what students understand. So the first one, what students think of as a sample, is kind of a la the Watson experiments and interviews along those lines. And then I guess 2 and 3 sort of fall into that umbrella too of what Watson had been talking about. And what they had been covering really in their interviews in terms of representation and bias and the idea of sample size, which I thought the one thing we talked about a little bit last time that was interesting in the Watson article was that they had fed them a sample size and kind of said, you know, how big do you think it should be? Is 10 good enough? And then I would be curious to see just what kind of the cold call answers would be if you just said, how big do you think a sample size is? What would students say? And what type of answers would you get there? I think that would be interesting. And then the idea, this had been talked about, number 4 had been talked about in other articles, where the idea of a sample being representative of the population and therefore it should look like the population and share characteristics with the population, but different samples are not going to be identical, is really, like, I guess I had never realized before reading it, I had never realized how actually contradictory that is. I hadn't sat down and thought about it. But looking at that and seeing when students hear that for the first time, do they think about it? Do they focus on it? Is it kind of a deal breaker for them in terms of kind of believing statistics and what we're trying to do here? Or do they have some way where they can kind of make sense of it in their own mind? So I'm thinking of this in terms of almost an informal inference type thing. So what do they come into the course with, or kind of the first time they hear this before we're trying to teach them, what do they make of it in terms of how can they reconcile sample representation with sample variability? And then also some of the other articles we had talked about talked about the spectrum of student belief in samples, where they either tend to put too much faith in a sample without recognizing the limitations of some samples, or that some samples are better than others for providing higher quality information, or that they just don't trust anything that is a sample. They only see bias, or they think they only see unfairness, and they think you have to have the entire population before you could really make a reasonably confident decision. And then my last question starts to get into the idea of going from one sample to many samples. And part of here was actually inspired by the comments from the simulations that we had talked about. When you introduce simulation, they seem to have confusion between the number of samples and the sample size. And how does that confusion affect their understanding? And when they start to think of a sampling distribution as just a super large sample as opposed to a bunch of different samples, does that cause problems later down the line for their understanding of inference and p-values and the like? So those are my ideas. And like I said, I think I focused on the sampling issue in part because it was recent and in part because I was just kind of amazed at how big it turned out to be.
Wow.
So that's mine. Questions or comments on that?
Well, with the two extremes you mentioned about students' understanding of sampling, either not wanting to trust a sample or wanting to prematurely trust it, one thing I was thinking is that I don't remember ever seeing anyone look at like some of the affective things, like do they tend to believe it if it's something they want to believe from the beginning and tend to distrust it, if it's something that just kind of popped into my mind when you were talking about that, because it's been in the research literature that there are those two extremes, but then it kind of goes back to that context piece again. And, you know, do their contextual knowledge or beliefs, you know, how does that influence the amount of faith that they put into a sample? It seems pretty interesting, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if you could almost give students, you know, identical sampling scenarios, and then give different students different conclusions out of them and see if the context and what the final conclusion was affects their willingness to accept that, or if they might try and, you know, if they didn't want to believe it, if they might try and look for some source of bias, or then even vice versa, give them the same conclusion with different sampling scenarios, one where that was a reasonable conclusion and one where it's not, and see.
Yeah, like kind of like parallel situations, or at least mathematically or statistically parallel situations with different contexts.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Talk about yours?
Sure. Well, mine are incredibly broad and incredibly large, so Jackie, don't feel bad.
But, I think we all have them broad.
I think mine are like, you know, and I did. I had a problem with this when I was starting out with my dissertation. My questions were like huge, and it did. It's just something that I do, and it takes me a while to get them narrowed down to something actually doable. So the first one, I think, actually more or less went back to one of our first conference calls when we were talking about conditional probability and how do students understand p-value. I know that just kind of connected with me because even though I know a p-value is a conditional probability, I'd never really sort of focused on that aspect when I was teaching it. I mean, I always said, you know, you assume the null hypothesis is true, blah, blah, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think that I had explicitly necessarily made the connection when I was teaching between conditional, that it's a conditional probability. And so now that I'm, you know, sort of toward the end of the semester and talking a lot about p-values and sort of struggling with students and, so I don't know, that was just kind of an interesting point for me and sort of stuck with me. And I know we talked a lot about, you know, what is the connection between inference and probability, and with all the discussion, we've had a lot of discussions about, you know, whether you even need to have a section on probability in an intrastat course. Of course, that's a very broad topic, but, you know, I think something looking at, you know, students' understanding perhaps of just what a conditional probability is, and is there any connection to how they understand a p-value? There might be something in there. The second one, again, hugely broad, just talking about sequence of topics. I thought we talked about that, and I was trying to look through the notes and figure out where I got that from when I put that up. But maybe we were talking about the...
We talked about that with sampling distributions. We talked about the proportions versus sampling distributions for means at one point.
Yeah.
It was.
So maybe that was what I was thinking.
It was in August.
Yeah, so is there any, does that have any effect on their understanding? Is one better than the other? I was also thinking somewhat about, you know, some of the randomization tests that we saw, that I know Herla and I saw this at USCOTS, and that's something, you know, that you can even do on, like, the first day of class, and, you know, you're sort of doing informal, I know I do, like, little informal inferences. I try to sort of sprinkle that in along the way before I ever get to hypothesis tests, but it doesn't seem like such a big idea when we actually do get to it. Again, hugely broad. I'm not really helping to narrow anything down here. And then the last, I think, everybody else has sort of talked about in much more detail. I really like the Watson experiment that they did looking at students' conceptual or conception of sample throughout, you know, the K through 12 level, and I think it would be incredibly interesting to see if that those same sorts of ideas persist at the college level. I thought it was really interesting, and you know, just being I know I said this the last conference call, you know, just being a statistician so long, it never occurred to me that a sample would be a sample of food or something like that. It just, and so it was interesting to sort of hear what non-statisticians, you know, that's what they initially think, and that all the students are bringing all these different other conceptions in that are sort of fighting what we're trying to get them to think about with a sample. And the other ideas, yeah, I'm sort of picking on that one thing. But then, so, yeah, I think the last two we've already, everybody else has sort of talked about, so I'm going to cheat a little and say that we already talked about those. I'm sorry, I did not narrow these down at all as I'm sitting here talking about these. I'm brushing with really broad strokes. So, I do have to apologize. Questions? Comments? All right, so...
We're a talkative group today.
I know, I was going to say, is everyone ready to just basically...
Everyone just needs a break.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that I've noticed is it seems like many of us in some form or another touched on the Watson experiment a little bit, or at least this idea of sample representation. So is that, I mean, that's something that was recent. Is that something that still really interests people?
Apparently. Well, I think we've talked about that almost at every conference call in some form or another, the representativeness of a sample and sort of approached it from different angles, you know, whether students trust it or not. And then, you know, the Watson experiment was just what is their conception of a sample. You know, I think almost every conference call we've looked at samples and just kind of looked at it from different angles. So I think that is something that sort of pervaded our discussions. And I think we're all interested in some format or another.
And for me, it's like that kind of question and the idea of, you know, if context influences that, obviously, I think are two different things we all kind of touched on some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems, you know, before now we kind of had the sampling and the probability strains, and I think the context thing kind of is emerging as a third contender. We seem to be creating topics rather than narrowing them down. But I think, I mean, they're all really interesting topics. They're all really important parts of our course, or of, you know, the kind of general intro stat level course. So maybe one of the things we can do from here is just kind of pick one, flip a coin or randomly generate a number or something like that, and then start to think about, like, okay, if we really did want to formalize this and did want to narrow down a research question, what question would we get at? What would we need? And actually start to think about, really, how would we measure these things and what would we do? And then if we can do that for two or three of those big ideas that keep coming up, once we have a better idea of the whole big picture, we can decide which area we want to tackle. Because it seems like we're really interested in all three areas, so maybe looking at it from a more pragmatic point of view of what can we really get at in our classrooms, what would really be accessible to us, maybe that can help us narrow our focus, our interest a little. Does that make sense, what I was suggesting?
Yeah, I guess maybe, Randy, do we really need to have it narrowed down for next month, or?
Let's see. I just had, I think, what did I do with that email? I just had the email that had the description of what's going on at the conference call next month, and now I lost it. I think, though, that it said, I'll try to find it again, but I think it said that they would like the each cluster to report out on the research questions that they're working on. So they don't necessarily have to be finalized yet. So I think that, you know, if there are three or four possible research questions at this point, that would still be okay. Okay, actually, I just found it now. Too much email. gosh, where is it? Okay. The purpose of the webinar is to have each group report on their progress, what they've been doing, what research questions they're formulating, and next steps. And then it says they'll be providing some general information to all the clusters, such as the structure of a JSM session for next August. So really, as far as reporting out, it's you know, it does say what research questions that are being formulated. So it's not as if, you know, right now that you have to have the final research questions in place. It's really just what are the working research questions at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then next steps would be like, well, you know, if there are some specific data gathering ideas, you know, that people have to address the questions, then you know, those can be brought up too.
Randy, in the presentation that they gave us last July, or in July, they said that we had to have a written plan for a literature review after 6 months. Is that not true? I mean, is that not our...
It's yeah, they do want the literature reviews, but they aren't asking for the literature reviews at the conference. I think that, I mean, at the conference call, I think that there's at least an outline, or there's a list of articles that you know, that the group has read up to this point. So that sounds like it's starting to form the basis for the literature review.
Okay, because January is 6 months.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we do certainly have some literature that we've been tracking, and I mean, we even have a more formal kind of annotated bibliography from two calls ago.
Yeah.
And I think that as we start to narrow in on research questions, that may also then start to guide us in terms of where we need to keep going in the literature, what aspect of the literature we need to explore again. So I think that the research questions and the literature review are something that will evolve together to some extent.
Yeah,
I think that's often how it works, yeah.
And I think one thing that's been good about the exercise of this call is it really does seem like we kind of all are settling in on similar themes, or similar themes stuck out to each of us throughout the course of our time. So I do think we have it reasonably well. I think, you know, we could identify reasonably well a small handful of research questions that would be of interest to all four of us.
Strangely for myself, while we've been talking, I kind of try to write something I think that's hopefully a little bit more narrow, that kind of encompasses a couple of things that I think that we are possibly interested in. So I try to write, and you can tell me to see if it makes sense. I have, like, are students more willing to trust results that match what they expected? So it kind of gets the idea of the context, and it kind of still has the idea of, you know, the idea of the sample at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But might be somewhat narrow enough to answer. I guess I just feel, you know, the whole idea of students trusting a sample in the first place seems to have so much to do with the context. Like, you know, the whole idea of they trust a sample of marbles from, you know, a jar very easily. Because, you know, they don't really have very many expectations when it comes to that kind of stuff. But once, you know, if they find out and they believe that, you know, the boys' mean should be higher than the girls' mean, if that doesn't happen, are they less willing to trust that that sample is representative? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
At all?
Yeah.
That was just one thing I wrote down kind of while we were talking.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of that's an interesting way, I think, too, to get at the idea of, you know, do they trust, if it's something they expect or they want to believe, you know, differentiating it by gender might be really interesting because, you know, you could even tie in with some of the, eventually bring in some of the research on gender and education and, you know, if that was the direction that you went with it.
Yeah, wasn't one of the questions in the last article, we had a discussion about that. There was a question that was very biased toward the boys.
The car
question.
Yeah, the car question.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be something. I think what we would need to do there is we would really need to kind of brainstorm and think about what are these different aspects and try and isolate them as much as possible. So the pure context of it, and then, like, the conclusion, does the conclusion meet their expectations? Was the sampling method appropriate or not? Like, was there an obvious source of bias or something? And then we could kind of generate scenarios that would meet, that would fall into each of those categories or would address each of those pieces and get student feedback on what they thought or what they thought problems with the research were, or did they find the research believable or something along those lines. Is that kind of what you were thinking, Jackie?
Yeah, but, you know, like, even if the sample truly is representative, you know, it just kind of seems like there's, you know, two of the exact same scenario, but, you know, one was against what you expected and one was what you expected. You seem to trust the one more kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there would even be, like, for that topic, it seems like there would be a lot of studies that have been done that students, you know, if they were given a synopsis of it, like, there was research, I don't know, a couple of decades almost ago about teachers calling on boys more than girls and treating boys differently from girls. You know, it'd be interesting to see how they interpret it. And I don't know if there were, I've never actually read one of the original reports from that, but I imagine that there are probably some quantitative studies that were done on that. So, I don't know, there might be some, you know, either formulating scenarios or there might even be enough out there of interest that they could be given, like, a little synopsis of a study that was conducted and kind of the statistics that were reported and the sample size and that sort of thing and see how they interpret it.
So looking at our time here, I think we have about 5 more minutes before Lee needs to go.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk about where we go from here and what we take from this call, what our next steps are.
Well, would it be, I mean, just one suggestion, I mean, would it make sense to have everyone maybe try to formulate their top research question at this point and then compare them? Or is everyone pretty much converging in on the same kind of idea? That's what I'm not sure of.
Well, just speaking for myself, I really like either this idea of the contextual problem that we've been talking about today, or students, what student understanding is of sample, kind of, as I said, kind of like the Watson experiment. I think if, like, for me, those are sort of the two that really, so far, that I've really sort of jumped out at me, just for me personally. So I don't know what everybody else thinks.
I think that's where I'm at, too.
Those both sound good to me, too, because, I mean, even though, you know, obviously I seem to love the idea about probability, that's, you know, so much, I think, harder to do until this is done. You know, if a student can't trust a sample in the first place, there's no way they get to inference.
Right.
Well, anyway.
Well, what if we then took either the question that Jackie just suggested, and we can start to then brainstorm on, okay, what are things that, what are ways we could address that question? What are important things we would need to look at in the literature? What are important things we might need to address or that we would really want to ask the students and learn from the students? So start to put in a little, think about a little bit more of the nuts and bolts pieces of the research. And we can do another Google Docs page, and we can start to put up ideas and kind of work off of each other's ideas and build things up that way. And we could do something similar for the Watson experiment. One of the nice things about the sampling thing is since we do have the Watson experiment to build on, we have a more concrete starting base, so we could even take that and think about what might we want to tweak. I think we all identified a few things in the experiment that we might have done differently. So what would those things be? And we can kind of just see what evolves out of those threads, those two threads simultaneously. And like I said, that may really guide us then in helping us narrow down which problem we really, really like and which problem we really think is doable. Or does that seem like way too much in a month when everyone's dealing with finals and holidays and everything? We can maybe plan it for more than a month, too.
Are we wanting to talk again before the 18th?
I don't know. I think based on this call, we have a good idea of what the big research questions of interest for us are. Certainly the context, the sampling, and then also the probability a lot of people seemed interested in. We have some demonstrated research history, so we may not need a call before the big call.
Yeah, you know, with the idea that you had about the Google Doc, if, for example, you know, someone posted the working research question at this point, and then other people contributed, like, okay, this study is related to it, this study is related to it, and then, like you said, maybe some ideas for the method. You know, there could be, like, little categories on there, like, for research question, method, related literature. It actually, like, even form a rough outline of a paper eventually. And it would also give whoever reports on the progress of the group, they'd have a nice kind of a page to look at and read from during the conference call.
Yeah. So I think that's something we could start maybe with no, like, fixed deadline. So no fixed deadline of we have to have this done before our next call on date X. Just let's start it and let's each try and work on it before the 18th so that it fits in, you know, we make some time for it, but let it be a little bit more organic.
Okay.
So, Jackie, do you want to go ahead and pose to the question that you just postulated?
Of course, you all can tweak it. You know, grammar isn't my strong suit. So.
Yeah, I was, while you guys were talking, I was trying to post a new page, and I accidentally called it Ideas for Contextual Research Experiment when I meant to say question, and I was trying to fix it, and now the research cluster page is telling me an error occurred while processing your request. So what I was going to do is put up two different pages, one for the contextual question and then one for the Watson sample. That was what I was going to do, so we could kind of have two separate areas for what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
And just kind of over the next month, see what we can put together.
Yeah.
For those.
And then I think we can decide, let's
beat Google Groups into submission.
Hold on.
Yeah. Sorry. One of the nice things about the Google Groups is it allows us to work together on something without having to set a definitive, like, we're going to call each other on this date, but maybe we should all agree that we'll look at it, you know, sometime mid-January and touch base and see how things are going right before the call?
Yeah, maybe leave, try to leave the Thursday 3 p.m. before it, just sort of open in case we all have a panic attack and think we need to talk before then.
Yeah. Well, I will be out of town that Thursday at the joint math meetings.
Okay. Well, then, I mean, you know.
I could still talk or email. I mean, I'll still have
email. Yeah, I mean, we can do this on email. And there is a discussion thread thing, although given how much this is annoying me right now, I don't know that I like Google Groups at the moment. Sorry.
Well, could we do it a different – I mean, could we plan for a different day just in case we need it?
How does Tuesday look for everyone?
Tuesday the 12th?
Ooh. Yeah, there's a webinar that day at 2 o'clock, but I don't host that one, so that's okay.
Tuesday the 12th is fine for me.
Fine for me.
3 o'clock, does that work?
I think so.
Okay. So we won't say that we're going to have a conference call, but we'll just kind of sort of leave, put that in your calendar just in case we feel like we need it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So then for next time we start editing those pages. We will definitely talk on the 18th with everyone, and then we'll kind of see how we're feeling about the 12th. So I think that's it. Is that all we need to cover? Anyone else have any other questions, comments?
No, I'm trying to get these pages up. So please email me if you continue to have problems with Google Groups. I don't know if I'm doing something wrong. I will ask Justin. but yeah, I know a couple of people, I know you guys have said that sometimes you edit something and then it won't let you go back in, and now it's doing it to me, so who knows what's going on. But yeah, so far it hasn't been disastrous. I mean, if you upload something, it just won't let you back in for a little while, but it does keep it, so nobody's work has been lost, so that's been good. Anyway, but yeah, just keep emailing me, because I guess I apparently am the administrator. Because I created the group. Okay.
As one last strange question, do we want to go ahead and appoint our speaker for the 18th? And do we want someone or all of us trying to take some notes of any kind?
That is a good question.
I mean, it seems unfair to, you know, just fully rotate our things. And I'd be the, you know, moderator, but I'm not going to have to moderate the entire conversation for the whole clusters. So,
yeah, since this seems like a presentation, I guess.
I mean, I don't know if we want someone trying to take good notes, or if we all want to kind of take notes of things that are important and kind of post a group thing about it, if that would probably work the best. I don't know.
Yeah. I would think there's going to be enough going on in the call that all of us taking notes is probably a good idea.
Okay.
And hopefully they'll also, you know, be recording it. Or
yeah, they record all that stuff, so we'll have a recording of it.
Yeah. I would think that in terms of our roles, we probably won't need those traditional roles for the next call because of the group nature of it. But appointing kind of our group representative to talk about what we've been doing is probably a good idea.
Well, and since we seem to have sort of two main forks that we're taking here, the contextual and the sample, do we want to maybe assign one person to each so that one person doesn't have to do it all? Or, I don't know. I don't know how comfortable people are presenting.
I'm pretty good at talking, so one thing should usually
follow. I will let that comment go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'd gladly let you do the speaking.
Yeah, no, I think all of us would be happy, Herla, if you want to talk.
Well, you know, I certainly don't mind. I do actually try and be conscientious of not dominating the conversation in these things because I don't want people to feel like I'm doing that. But I certainly would be happy if people didn't want to talk to do the talking. So I could go either way on that.
I think you're very well spoken. I think you, when you speak, you clearly articulate your ideas.
Well, thank you. Well, in that case, I will volunteer to talk about at least the sampling thread of this thing, of what we've been doing so far. So who wants to take the contextual part then?
I am kind of wondering if it'll be possible to separate the two that well. It seems like the research question kind of has elements of both in it. But I guess the literature could be different.
Okay.
Well, then let's see. Yeah, that may be true. So let's see how these pages kind of develop. And if we think we have enough for two independent threads, we can volunteer someone to do the contextual part.
Okay.
Does that sound good for everyone?
Sure.
All right. I think we're set then, unless anyone has any questions, comments, or concerns.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I hope everybody survives the end of the semester well and has an excellent holiday.
Yeah. You too, all of you.
Thank you. Please stand by.